Well, thank you so much, Asaf and Alex. I'm honored to be with you for a whole host of reasons. One of which is, of course, Asaf, you and I go way back, and I'm just such a great admirer of everything you're doing and your great leadership. And then, of course, your president, Jonathan Edelman, a great friend of mine for years. And so it's really a pleasure to be with SPME at a time when SPME's work is so critical. First of all, you know, scholars for peace in the Middle East. Well, my goodness, what a day yesterday. You know, we dream about peace and we crave peace. And here we have, I was honored to attend at the White House yesterday, this breathtaking and moving moment of real embrace, not just a normalization, you know, ink on paper, but a real embrace of the Jewish people and of Israel by two Arab states, and Arab states of real importance. You know, Bahrain is very forward-leaning and has been for quite some time. The UAE is a powerhouse, an economic and technological in many ways powerhouse. And so to have this embrace was just such an inspiration. Truly, truly, we're bringing peace in the Middle East, and it goes to show you that when you stand on principle, and when you stand with your friends, support and empower your friends, and weaken our adversaries, good things happen. We spend too much time doing the opposite, which of course brought us no closer to peace, but now we see that that a strong and assertive U.S. policy of leadership and support for Israel pays incredible dividends for the Jewish people, for the Arab people, for the Middle East, and really for a better world. And so, first of all, I have to say, to begin with that really extraordinary event yesterday, which means so much and carries with it so many implications for the future. Second of all, your work is so deeply important because anti-Semitism has always come with intellectual justification. And scholars, therefore, are especially important. I don't know if you saw, I'm sure many of you have, the op-ed by Cynthia Ozick in the Wall Street Journal, Anti-Semitism and the Intellectuals. I commend it to all of you for your reading. And she talks about how anti-Semitism isn't simply the province of the mob, but was always led by thought leaders who justified Jew hatred and justified it through, you know, through you know, rarefied and intellectually presented worldviews. And that's what made it so dangerous in the past, and that's what makes it so dangerous today. And we're seeing this again today. Of course, we all know that Nazism and Nazi ideology was fueled by the intellectual elite of Nazi Germany. A majority of the participants in the Wannsee Conference, that the conference that actually produced the final solution as a policy of Nazi Germany, a majority of the participants in the Wannsee Conference had doctoral degrees. And so, you know, here we saw that sort of the scholarly leadership of anti-Semitism was alive and well in the traditional anti-Semitism of the far right. We'll call it ethnic supremacy of the far right. But as we know, there are two other sources of anti-Semitism as well. There's the radical left, most closely associated with anti-Zionism and Israel hatred, and militant Islam. And both of those also are led by thought leaders. Militant Islam, all the time, are led by radical, dogmatic imams and scholars that preach and propagate the most vile Jew hatred. One of the reasons why yesterday, and the name of the event yesterday, the Abraham Accords, is so important, to go back to the days of philo-Semitism in the Arab and Muslim world. After all, we've had great periods of philo-Semitism in Arab and Muslim history. And so that's why this was so important. One of the many blows to radical Islam and the rejectionism and the hatred of not only Jews, but of the West that we see in militant Islam. But then in the radical left, the anti-Semitism of the radical left is largely led by scholars. We're seeing that all over the world. I've been involved on campus issues for 30 years. Before I was in my current role and accepted the appointment of President Trump and Secretary Pompeo, I was involved as a lay leader with AEPI, supervising at one point 10,000 students on 190 campuses in five countries. And now in my current role as special envoy, the things I hear from Jewish student leaders in Western Europe, in the UK, are the same things I've heard for years from Jewish student leaders in the United States. And that is that the price of being a safe student on these campuses, the cost of being able to go through campus unmolested, is a complete divorce from a critical part of one's Jewish identity, namely Zionism, the age-old attachment to the land of Israel. And if a student wants to be safe, one cannot talk about Israel, certainly not say the Z word, Zionism. And woe to that student who actually wants to express their Jewish identity fully, certainly that part of their Jewish identity, the connection to the land of Israel. And this, of course, is rank anti-Semitism. And sadly, we're seeing scholars lead this. I mean, Harvard has just announced that it's welcoming Saeb Arikat to mentor students. Of course, this is the same Palestinian Authority that has not only rejected every overture for peace, but condemns and rejects Arab-Israeli peace, condemned the Abraham Accords, and of course is presently engaged in efforts of indoctrinating their children in the most vile and rank anti-Semitism, printing books that are so appalling and so filled with Jew hatred that Hamas uses those same textbooks of the Palestinian Authority to teach at Hamas schools in Gaza. And of course, this is the same PA that pays murderers a monthly stipend, the pay for slave program, notorious for putting terrorists on a monthly payroll for their crimes. And he is mentoring students at Harvard University. Then let's go 3,000 miles away to the other side of the country. San Francisco State announced that Leila Khaled is invited as an honored speaker at San Francisco State. Leila Khaled is a hijacker convicted of terrorism. And apparently that is a distinction worthy of having her embraced by a university in the United States and being invited to speak. It's the same in Europe. It's the same in the UK. I've had student leaders tell me that one cannot mention Israel on some of the most prestigious campuses in Europe, because to mention Israel in a positive light would be to bring calamitous harassment on any student who would do that. And so this is a crisis. This is a crisis because we as a society and we as parents entrust our children to these institutes of higher learning for our children to be mentored and developed and elevated by what they're taught and not harassed and discriminated against and indoctrinated. And the harassment and the discrimination and the indoctrination is having an impact. A comprehensive study, a poll done by a leading pollster who surveyed Jewish university students in the United States found that Jewish university students in the United States are less supportive of Israel than ever before and more inclined to sympathize with Israel's enemies than ever before. And the crisis, their word, not mine, the crisis in the evangelical Christian community is how the young people are being lost. I was speaking at an international conference, and a pastor said to me, raised his hands. I didn't even touch on the subject of campuses, but he said, I want to tell you what's going on. We raise our kids to be pro-Jewish and pro-Israel as a matter of theology. For us, it's faith. And then we send them off to college, and they come back changed. Another event at which I spoke, a pro-Israel rally, a young evangelical Christian kid ran up to me afterwards and he said, you know, I'm here as a volunteer. I love Israel. And I said, well, thank you for being here. Let me ask you a question. Is it true what I'm hearing that young evangelicals are less supportive of Israel? And he said to me, oh my goodness, of course it's everywhere around us. I said, tell me, Matthew, why is that? And he said to me, because we also go to college. We also hear it all the time. And it has an impact. Now think about that. Evangelicals and Jews, those aren't just two constituencies. That's the base. If those two constituencies are being eroded, are being rent away from their principles, imagine everyone else. And lest anyone think that this crisis is confined to the campus world, the student world, not our world, let me tell you about the single most chilling meeting I have had in my last year and a half on the job, and that's saying a lot. I met with a UK Labour MP. This is before the election, when things looked bleak. I met with a UK Labour MP who walked out of the Labour Party because this MP said, I will not sit at the same table with anti-Semites. And this MP said to me in a meeting, this disaster that we have in England, disaster was the word the MP used, this disaster that we have in England all started on the campuses, but we did nothing because they were only students. And then it moved into the Labour Party. And we did nothing because, well, it was just the radical fringe. And today, they won and we lost, and I no longer have a political party I can call home anymore. I want you to know my hair stood on end. This is what we're facing. The indoctrination on campuses, aided by administrators and faculty, is constant. A kid at a premier university, premier, I won't say which one, but as good as it gets, handed me a copy of an answer sheet to his math class. And the answer sheet says, you know, the derivative of so-and-so is such-and-such, the integral of such-and-such is so-and-so. And then it says, another day in the occupied Palestinian territories, Zionist forces murdering children. And then it goes back to math. The kid who handed this to me said, in a voice reflecting utter exhaustion, said, in math class? I can't even escape this in math class? Well, that's right. You can't even escape it in math class. Because this war against the good name of the Jewish people and the state of Israel is 24/7, even in math class. And so that's why, my friends, your work is so deeply important. As Jew hatred is being led by intellectuals, so too should philo-Semitism be led by intellectuals. And so too should the defense of the good name of the Jewish people and the state of Israel be led by intellectuals. It's critical that we do it. And your work is central to doing that. Let me close with some good news, because while there's a lot of bad news, anti-Semitism is rising all around the world, on the far right, the radical left, and from militant Islam. But there's also a lot of good news. And let me just end with that. Piece of good news number one is that we are not alone. We have allies across the world, non-Jewish leaders at all levels, from heads of government to ministers to parliamentarians and anti-Semitism coordinators, who get it and are champions of our cause, not just friends, champions of our cause. They're fighting against Jew hatred because they know it's not only about protecting Jews, although that should be enough. It's a fight for the civilization of our time. And they understand that if Jew hatred, if anti-Semitism wins the day, they cannot bequeath to their children a society that is healthy and a continent, in many cases Europe, that is whole and that is healthy. And so we have these wonderful allies around the world, and it is without doubt one of my greatest privileges to work with them every day. And they are making an impact. It's why UK Labour was defeated, and it's why there was a civil war in that party. Now the party has cleaned house and has expressed a zero tolerance against anti-Semitism, not only expressed it, but enforcing it. It's why we have more and more law enforcement officers trained in hate crimes throughout Europe. It's why the German Bundestag and the Austrian Assembly passed measures that said that say BDS is anti-Semitism, groundbreaking, transformative. And so they are making a difference. And we are not alone, and we have great friends and partners. Piece of good news number two is that the Jewish people do have self-determination. The state of Israel does exist. And Jewish self-determination is represented by a shining example of democracy and freedom and tolerance, a self-critical press, a beacon for innovation, world-changing and humanity-uplifting innovation, and protected by an army the IDF, at once strong and faithful to principles of international law. The strength of the State of Israel and its outstanding exemplar for humanity makes the Jewish people strong everywhere in the world, and that much better able to confront anti-Semitism. And piece of good news number three is that despite rising anti-Semitism, the United States of America is still the most philo-Semitic country in the history of the world. Polls show that very clearly. Jews aren't tolerated in America. They are embraced with affection in America. And today, the United States is led by the most philo-Semitic administration we have ever had. From President Trump to Vice President Pence to my boss, Secretary Pompeo, Attorney General Barr, and then, of course, Jared Kushner and David Friedman and Avi Berkowitz, and the list goes on and on and on. We have never seen anything like this. And we are making gains every day against anti-Semitism, because the President of the United States is unprecedented in the commitment of this administration to fighting anti-Semitism, to protecting the Jewish people throughout the world, and to supporting the State of Israel. Let's look at all three kinds of anti-Semitism. The far right. We are the first administration in U.S. history to designate a far right white supremacist anti-Semitic group as a terrorist organization. Never before happened. The president has been active on every front in this case. He sent me to speak at the funeral of Lori Kay, where the White House authorized me to say Lori Kay, Zichrona Livracha, was murdered, as you know, in the attack at Poway, Chabad of Poway. And when I spoke, I said on behalf of the administration, and I was authorized to say that we are at war with these far-right ethnic supremacists who call themselves patriots, but really represent something that runs contrary to everything on which our country was built. Quite the contrary. It was exactly from this kind of blood libel and bloodlust that our founding fathers fled and broke away. And so they're not patriots. And I said that. The far right also is immersed in Holocaust denial. And here, too, the president has been groundbreaking. President Trump signed into law the Never Again Education Act, ensuring that future generations of students in this country will learn about the Holocaust and understand where far-right ethnic hatred leads. And so this has been groundbreaking. For the anti-Semitism coming from the radical left that focuses on Zionism, here too the president has been transformative. In December, President Trump signed an executive order that applies Title VI civil rights protections to students and adopts the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. This was a game changer. I was at the White House when President Trump signed that order. And after he signed it, he looked right at the cameras and he said, "Let me make this clear. If you are a university and you are promoting the harassment and discrimination of your Jewish students, this is going to be very expensive for you. You are going to lose a lot of money." And I promise you, there was not a single university president or chancellor we didn't read that loudly and clearly. And so we are serious about cleaning up this mess on our campuses. And certainly in my diplomacy overseas, this has been a critical focus of mine. And finally, the anti-Semitism of militant Islam, well, that focuses on Israel and on the state of Israel and on the right of Israel to exist. And here, my goodness, the president has supported Israel to a degree that we have never seen. From closing the PLO office in Washington, to defunding UNRWA so that U.S. tax money won't go to printing those textbooks anymore, to defunding the PA's pay-for-slave program, to recognizing the eternal and undivided capital of the State of Israel and the Jewish people, Jerusalem, and moving our embassy there, recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, taking the term occupied territories out of the UN Human Rights Report, denying visas to ICC prosecutors who have the audacity to call the heroes of the United States Armed Forces and the IDF war criminals, denying them visas to come here. And of course, acknowledging the Jewish people's historical connection and ties to Judea and Samaria, and putting forth a peace vision that really can bring us to peace in the Middle East fully, and a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian issue while acknowledging Jewish claims in Judea and Samaria. And so this is just remarkable, and the miracles and wonders never cease for what President Trump and Secretary Pompeo and the leadership team are willing to do to support the Jewish state and thereby combat the anti-Israel type of anti-Semitism that comes from both the radical left and militant Islam. So this is the good news. I am optimistic that with the leadership of the Trump administration and our continued efforts with our wonderful, great partners throughout the world, we will be able to roll back this terrible scourge of Jew hatred and bequeath to our children, build for our children that better, safer, and more just world that they so richly deserve. And I know in that work, we could have no better partner than SPME. The focus you bring on these issues, the determination you bring to going to the absolute core, the lion's den of this problem, and fighting it where it comes from, is absolutely critical for us. And so Chazak uVaruch, may you go from strength to strength. May all of us be blessed with a year of safety and health and success, a year where we see Jew hatred disappear from the world and where we see justice be propagated throughout the world. Thank you, Shana Tova u'mevorechet, and thank you for all that you do.
Thank you so much for those kind words, Ilan, and really, you know, we greatly appreciate it all around. It's a, as you know, it's an uphill battle, and, you know, like yourself, we're in it for the long run. So it's, you know, and with the leadership, like people like yourself and your team of all the work that has been done, you know, it is extremely, you know, very helpful and very positive all around, you know, things that we can do. So, so I want to thank you for the comprehensive, larger overview here. There's a lot of questions and a lot to dive into. As you know, and as you alluded in your remarks, basically what starts on campus does not end on campus. And a lot of the environment that we've been dealing with and a lot of the, what I would consider to be the cognitive dissonance, no matter what happens on the ground in the region, the reality on the campuses is very different and far removed from the reality is on the ground. And so the ideological scholarly activism that has been, you know, semi-pseudo scholarship has been replacing and been infusing our the halls of the academy with a lot of propaganda, which is exactly, you know, to your point, what we've been dealing with. Let me the floor is now open for everybody to ask questions. If you have questions, I see there are a few in the chat. I will tackle them. If you have questions you want to ask, please also you could raise your hand and I will also unmute you and ask your question as well. Alex, why don't you start us off? I know Ilan gave a big global overview here, but why don't you start off with the first question and then I'll dive into the questions after that.
Okay, very good. Well, let me also say thanks for your good work and for your comprehensive overview of where we're at, some good places and some bad places, obviously. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the administration's position on the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which has been very controversial, obviously, in the past, especially on campus, especially with regard to free speech issues, and how this definition works, let's say, administratively within across the executive branch of the government. I know that the State Department had formally adopted it some few years ago, and the Education Department has moved in that direction. With, you know, well thought out language, let's say. But what about other departments and what about active implementation?
Well, that's a great question. So, first of all, the importance of the IHRA definition is that in its examples, that's really where the meat of it is. In its examples, it encompasses not only, you know, the kind of traditional medieval anti-Semitism, you know, Jews controlling the world, responsible for all, you know, all of the pathologies of the world. You know, we're seeing this now a lot in the, it's nothing new about this, of course, it goes back forever, but we're seeing it now a lot with the coronavirus. As the world has moved online, you know, we're seeing a tsunami of anti-Jewish venom on the internet and social media. accusing Jews baselessly of having, you know, invented the virus or transmitting it. So, but not only do the IRA definitions examples comprise that kind of traditional anti-Semitism, also dual loyalty allegations, but it also encompasses what's often called the new anti-Semitism, although there's nothing new about it, but the so-called new anti-Semitism of anti-Zionism. So one of the examples is denying the Jewish people's self-determination, the right of self-determination, for example, by claiming that the existence of Israel is a racist endeavor. That's given as an example. Applying a double standard to the state of Israel that to which no other democracies held is an example. Targeting the state of Israel, the Jewish state, as a Jewish collectivity, or comparing Israel to the Nazis, all examples of anti-Semitism. And that's very, very powerful, because when it comes to the anti-Semitism of the left, this fig leaf of anti-Zionism sometimes causes people of goodwill not to call it out for what it is, not to condemn it. Well, you know, this is a political issue, perhaps. I hear that a lot in Europe in my travels, and I hear that certainly on campuses. Well, it's, you know, once there's a country involved, well, no, it doesn't work that way. Hatred of the Jewish state is hatred of the Jewish people. There's only one Jewish state in the world. If you hate it, it's hatred of the Jewish people. It's very simple, really. And the IRA definition helps make that clear. Now, you said it's controversial. I actually don't think it's very controversial. IRA adopted it, the alliance itself adopted it unanimously. More and more countries are adopting it every day. Argentina just adopted it. I believe Kosovo just adopted it. I mean, it's being adopted by more and more countries. It really isn't controversial. Now, you know, where is it controversial? Well, it's controversial among those who wanna traffic in anti-Semitism. They don't like it. And so when you go to campus, suddenly it's controversial. You know, organizations that are openly anti-Semitic, like JVP or SJP, oppose it with every fiber of their being, because they say, well, you know, this is somehow a limitation on our free speech. This is utter nonsense. This has nothing to do with free speech. In fact, the IRA definition supports free speech, encourages free speech and debate by offering an accepted definition that we can discuss. There's nothing in the IRA definition about censorship. You know, look, the fact that you can call someone out for being anti-Semitic doesn't mean that they're not protected by the First Amendment. You know, the Nazis marched in Skokie, and that's a Supreme Court case. What does that mean? That they're not anti-Semitic because they had a right to march in Skokie? This is a ridiculous calumny on the IRA definition that somehow this is against free speech. The truth is, these anti-Semitic groups don't like it because it provides a benchmark through which their work can be called anti-Semitic. It allows us to point to an objective, accepted definition to say, hey, what you're doing is anti-Semitism, clear and simple. And they don't want that. They don't want that. So that's why they're opposing it. Now, it is adopted for the federal interagency because President Trump, in his December executive order, specifically adopts the IRA definition for agencies to consider what might rise to the level of a Title VI civil rights violation. So in that sense, although you are right, the State Department has been using it for a number of years now. Now, as of December, the interagency has adopted it thanks to President Trump's executive order. And it is a great, great step forward. You should know one of my top diplomatic asks overseas, if a country has not adopted the IRA definition, I ask that they adopt it nationally and that they implement it through training and through education. And that's critical. And we're urging, by the way, we're urging the internet and social media platforms to adopt it. It's critical as the internet and social media has become the chief vector of this disease of Jew hatred. It's critical that the social media platforms adopt the IRA definition.
Thank you for that. That's very helpful. Let me move on to Alex. You have a follow-up, or do you want me to try?
No, please go ahead. Let's get to some questions.
Okay. So let me try to unmute here, Leonard. Leonard, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Mr. Ambassador, I would like, if you don't mind, to raise a controversial issue. You described several streams of anti-Semitism with radical left and radical right, as well as Islamic anti-Semitism. I would like to make the case that we shouldn't ignore Black anti-Semitism. And what I'm specifically referring to is the legacy of Malcolm X and Farrakhan and the Black Hebrews. And the fact that every day in Crown Heights and throughout the city, we're seeing acts of anti-Semitism that are clearly racially or have some implications for a racial perspective. I think we can't ignore that, and we can't simply define that as a subunit of identity politics or progressive radical left. And I'd like to hear your response to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so absolutely we can't ignore it, Leonard. I couldn't agree with you more. I was very vocal in calling out the Black Lives Matter movement after the riots, and where there were horrific examples of anti-Semitism and vandalism, broken windows and vandalized synagogues. I visited actually one of the vandalized synagogues, terrible. And of course, the platform of some of the, you know, BLM is sort of an umbrella, if you will, but some of the constituent organizations in the movement have had it at times openly anti-Semitic platforms, have adopted BDS, and have accused Israel of nothing short of blood libel, the blood libel. So it's very important that we call out these movements. I will say also with regard to the attacks in the tri-state area, I led a delegation of three members of Congress, the Attorney General of New Jersey and the Chief of State Police of New Jersey, to visit the Jersey City site of the attacks against the Jewish community there, the murderous attacks there. And I stood before, you know, I had a community meeting there with the full delegation, and then we had a press conference, and we made very clear that this needs to be called out. The reason why I don't list it as a separate category is because I really think it's part of the same category. I mean, I never talk about white supremacy. You notice I didn't say far-right white supremacy. I said far-right ethnic supremacy. Sometimes it has nothing to do with whiteness. If you go to some European movements, chilling neo-Nazi movements in some parts of Eastern and Central Europe, or not only, by the way, they're in Western Europe too. These are, you know, ethnic national types of movements that are far right. So I don't talk about white supremacism. I talk about ethnic supremacism. And whatever the ethnicity is, if the view is that that ethnicity is superior to all others and all other, you know, ethnicities are inferior and should be loathed, that is what I call far-right ethnic supremacism, and I don't care what the skin color is. Second of all, a lot of this what we have seen, you know, the statements of several celebrities, the Crown Heights attacks, we're seeing influences here from Louis Farrakhan, who has been notorious in his public anti-Semitism, and I've called out Minister Farrakhan for being anti-Semitic openly, and I'll tell you that also is a form of militant Islam. It might not be traditional Middle East militant Islam, but it's another form of militant Islam. So whether you characterize this as one or the other, or a mix between sort of far-right ethnic supremacism with militant Islam, it's not unusual to have combinations. By the way, you see the red green alliance, right? So why shouldn't there be a red black alliance? We call it all out. And as I said from day one, in fact, my very first public speech, is that we will not ignore or minimize any of these streams of anti-Semitism. Jew hatred is Jew hatred. I don't care what ideological clothing it wears. And if you're not going to confront all of it and combat all of it, then why bother combating any of it? If you leave, you know, two-thirds or even one-third of a tumor untreated, the patient doesn't do well. And so you got to fight. You have to fight all of it. If you're serious about fighting it at all, you have to fight all of its streams.
Great, thank you. Let's go on to Francis. Let's see if I can unmute Francis. Francis, can you hear us? Francis. Okay. Let's move on to another question we had here. Let's try Philip. Philip, can you hear us? Philip,
can you hear me now?
Yes, you can.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Anyways, I'm so glad to be a part of this. The one thing that bothers me the most, and it's generally not addressed, is open anti-Semitism within the Democratic Party. whether it's the squad, notably Ilhan Omar or Rashid Tlaib, both of whom are unapologetic anti-Semites. And there are Jews, sadly, within the Democratic Party, whether it be Chuck Schumer or others, who or even Elliot Engel, they just will not speak out against it. They will not condemn them. And it's, as a Jew, obviously, I'm tremendously offended by that. And I'm just wondering, how is it that we could address this, or how we could get more Democrats either to leave their party and realize that there's really no space for Jews within the Democratic Party, or just simply to address these open anti-Semites and perhaps have them kicked out of the party?
Thank you.
So I you know, this webinar that we're doing right now was delayed by 2 hours. And the reason why it was delayed is because I was on a call with President Trump, his high holiday call to Jewish leaders across the country, including, by the way, Jewish leaders on the left. It was a, you know, full spectrum, bipartisan, right, left, liberals, conservatives. And President Trump did exactly what you just said. He called out Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. He said it would have been unimaginable a few years ago to hear what is being said in the halls of Congress, in the greatest democratic deliberative body in history. It would have been unthinkable. And now it is said. And so he did do that. And he did it very strongly. I think, you know, we've seen my boss, Secretary Pompeo, do that very strongly. And he did it in a speech at AIPAC before 18,000 people. He called out anti-Semitism from members of Congress. So we are in this administration doing that. Now, let me say something very important, though. Very important not to, put everyone on the same boat here. I mean, look, I'll tell you, I work with senators and members of Congress all the time in bipartisan fashion. I've worked with great leaders. I mean, Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, my goodness, you couldn't find somebody who's more passionate about our issues and more courageous in terms of calling out, including fellow Democrats. He'll call them out. Max Rose has been very good in many respects. Ted Deutch, I mean, I could go on, even go to the leadership. Steny Hoyer has said some very strong things. And you mentioned Elliot Engel. Elliot Engel was, let me tell you, he was brutal on the Obama administration. Brutal. I mean, when President Obama, pummeled Israel for 8 years, pummeled Israel betrayed Israel at the UN, and the Iran nuclear deal came out against the Iran nuclear. I mean, he was vicious on standing for principles. So I don't think Elliot is a good example. I think he's fantastic. But, you know, I think that it's very important to remember that, there are a lot of good Democrats out there, Democratic members, but also Democratic voters. And it's important not to paint them all with the same brush. But at the same time, regardless of what party each of us, each of you might be in, or each of the Americans who are going to listen to this, regardless of party, we've got to be fair, and we've got to call out anti-Semitism wherever it comes from. We cannot give it quarter. Even if it comes from, if Democrats say, well, it comes from this left and I'm a member of the left, so what? I mean, there are left-wing leaders who have stood up, and look at Zionists, or look at Barry Weiss, who have said, I will not tolerate anti-Semitism. I might be liberal, but anti-Semitism is evil, and I'm going to call it out. That's what we need to demand of everybody, to be fair and call out anti-Semitism everywhere and anywhere it rears its ugly head.
Thank you. So let me,
I'm sorry, I neglected to mention also, I was thinking about the House. So I mentioned a lot of members of Congress, of the House of Representatives, but the Senate has been tremendous. And I'll just give one example. There was a newly formed Senate bipartisan task force on anti-Semitism, created by Senator Jackie Rosen and Senator James Lankford together, Democrat and Republican. I work with Senator Rosen and her staff all the time. So, you mentioned representatives, and so that's where I was giving an answer there. But I should also say that in the Senate as well, you've got incredible leaders in the Senate who are really doing great things. And Jackie Rosen, by the way, was heavily involved in passing the Never Again Education Act that I mentioned earlier as a great example of good things we're doing. Well, Jackie Rosen was one of the one of the spearheaders of the Never Again Education Act. So again, it's just very important that we you know, there are good people and not good people. It's very important that we draw that line and not, you know, not paint too wide a brush, because then we really do disservice to some really good friends we have who are doing good things.
Great, thank you. Elon, let me chime in for a second. Let me ask you a question. I mean, I want to go a little bit back to your point about Title VI. Obviously, there are two kinds of Title VI. You know, and the one that addresses the issue of Jews as minorities on campus, very important, very critical when it comes to the toolbox of students, which is obviously mentally critical when, you know, obviously they have had a difficult time proving the fact that they are minorities on campus and getting the same rights. Given that the majority of our members are indeed faculty, and with the growth of what we've been seeing now of cancel culture, of individuals who have spoken out on campuses around the country and are being basically are called in for meetings and have to come in, you know, for fear of being fired. The administration is leaving them hanging because of what they are saying and speaking out, and then basically left hanging because the views don't conform necessarily with the orthodoxy of the day. Is there, in your mind, a way? I know the, you know, we've had some of these conversations also with our mutual friend Ken Marcus, related to faculty, because I know that the Title VI is a limitation on the issue regarding students. But is there another tool that we're thinking about, or your office is thinking about, you know, addressing to also the other part, which is critical, constituency, the community of the campus related to faculty and administrators when they're being targeted?
Well, that's why it's so important that we, you know, it's strength in numbers. I mean, you can fire one professor, but you can't fire, you know, you can't fire professors that are in large numbers across multiple departments. And let me give you some tangible examples, you know, a study in contrast. First of all, let's take Cal Berkeley, my alma mater. I'm very proud Golden Bear, and I love the school. It was a great experience, but let's face it, not a friendly neighborhood in many respects, for the Jewish pro-Israel crowd. And I'll tell you that that there was a, I'm sure many of you read it, an anonymous letter by a member of the faculty who expressed certain views, and said, I can't say this publicly. They were conservative views. This didn't really touch on Israel, but he said, I can't express, if I express this publicly, if I sign my name to this, not only will I be fired, but I won't be hired by anyone else. And that's on, you have that example on one side. Many of you, I'm sure, read that letter. And then look at the other side. At USC, a large number of very distinguished professors, including a Nobel laureate, signed a letter of absolute outrage at what happened at USC, at the rank anti-Semitism with which student leaders were run out of town, basically run out of town, and resigned their positions. And a faculty went on the record. This wasn't an anonymous letter, and a large number of faculty, distinguished faculty, said, this is outrageous. And they signed a letter and they put their names on it. What, are they gonna fire them? They're gonna fire a Nobel laureate over this? No, they're not. And so really, that's why your work is so important. We have to, first of all, empower faculty who understand, who get it, and who are appalled, who are genuinely embarrassed by what their colleagues are doing and what the administrators are doing. And by the way, it is embarrassing. There's no better word. It's embarrassing for our country, what's going on. And we've got to find those faculty. We've got to organize them, we've got to empower them, we've got to support them, and then we've got to get them to go on the record. And the more and more we can get in joint letters to go on the record and say, this is a disgrace, it's unacceptable that we're doing this, and that's how you breed change. I promise you that for all of those USC faculty that signed their name to that letter, there are many more out there that nodded their heads when reading it. And when that Berkeley professor wrote what he wrote, I'm sure there were many who read it and said, boy, oh boy, that's right. I certainly wouldn't go public with those views either. You know, there is a silent majority out there, even on campuses. And so it's important that we reach out and empower those people. And I tell you, this is the fight of our time. This battle for not only for the future of the Jewish people, for philo-Semitism versus anti-Semitism, but this battle really for American values, for the values on which our country was built. This battle will be won or lost on the campuses. There is no two ways about it. And so, you know, the reason why I'm here today is to tell you that you are, your work is absolutely critical for our future. And it's exactly what we need to do to you know, get more and more people to organize, to be empowered, to go on the record and to fight.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, and that is actually, you know, obviously, as you know so well, the raison d'etre of SPME's existence. I mean, we all came together to begin with because to create that community and that network of support, because again, individuals, as you know so well, feel marginalized. They feel ostracized at times from their own colleagues. And so it's become harder and harder, you know, because of the political toxicity, the environment, the cancel culture, you know, that this is indeed, again, as I said in my, you know, my remark before, I think that what we are observing is that notwithstanding the reality on the ground, notwithstanding with the tremendous historical significance of yesterday, the reality on the campus is detached from that reality. And the religion of the day is, you know, the religion of, you know, being anti-Israel is a litmus test for what we find to be what it means to be a rank and file member of the faculty. And that has become extremely difficult. The challenge that I think that we're all seeing is younger faculty. I mean, tenured faculty, tenure still helps, not a guarantee as far as a safety net, but, you know, people, younger people who are coming into, especially in the humanities, so this is not, the STEM areas are not immune from any of this. But, you know, it's not easy to be that representative and speak out, which is, again, the empowerment is critical. I mean, I think, which is, you know, to my point, you know, I think that, you know, the Title VI, you know, is a great toolbox that we're fighting today. We are making significant inroads, as you know so well, when it comes to areas of lawfare, which are helping expose what's going on the campuses. But the environment is not friendly, to say the least.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, in addition to the great work that you all are doing in civil society, there are things that we're looking at too. And I obviously, some of these are confidential policy positions, but, you know, we all know that, you know, that they're all coming. This has been in the news, right? So I'm not saying anything that's not in the newspapers, but, you know, there are funding issues that have been widely covered. With regard to universities, where is the money coming from, and is it being reported accurately? And so, you know, I think it's really a, you know, it's a full court press, and we need to be working, all of us. You know, we on the government side, but also civil society and SPME, a shining example among them. We all have to work together to, you know, to clean this up. And again, this isn't about censorship or stifling free speech. It's about, you know, it's about, you know, ending harassment and discrimination. It's actually about allowing free speech. It's about ending the cancellation and the coercement of those people who like Jews and like Israel, you know, and by the way, who like America. About ending the harassment of those people, whether they be students or faculty. And so This is really a critical fight of our time.
Great. Alex, another question?
Yeah, let me follow up in a sense on campus issues and the other another part of this equation is, of course, the international community. And I live out in the New York area, and we are always alerted when the UN General Assembly is in session, which began actually yesterday, a very different kind of session, as did the session of the Human Rights Council, 2 days ago. So I was wondering whether you could speak a little bit about the administration's approach to anti-Semitism in this venue, which to my mind, legitimizes and disseminates anti-Semitism at a uniquely high and uniquely global sort of level.
Well, I think we're on the record loudly and clearly on that. I don't think, you know, when I rattled off all of the great achievements of this administration in fighting for the Jewish people in the state of Israel, I didn't mention this, but I could have easily mentioned yet one more thing, and that is that we walked out of the Human Rights Council. I mean, talk about a clear message. We said we will not sit at this table anymore, where Israel is singled out from all the countries in the world and targeted in the most anti-Semitic fashion, targeted for opprobrium, even while other things in the world, some of which are calamitous human rights atrocities, are largely ignored. And so we wouldn't be a party to that anymore. And so we picked up our chips and walked out. And I'm very proud of President Trump for doing that, and Secretary Pompeo. It was very courageous, and it's the right thing to do, because, you know, you want to work within a body and make it better. But if they won't change, you know, we're not gonna sit there and accord legitimacy to what they're doing. And so we take a very strong view of this. I mentioned earlier that we've sanctioned, literally sanctioned, ICC prosecutors who focus on the heroes of the United States and the armed forces and the IDF, call them war criminals, open criminal investigation. It's appalling. And so we said, no, you know, if you're going to target the brave soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors of the United States and the IDF, you're not going to come here and come to Disneyland. You're not going to visit. You're not going to tour New York, because you know, we're not going to let you come here. And I think that is a great move. We have zero tolerance for these UN bodies who are going to single out Israel and you know, try to delegitimize and demonize the one Jewish state. And that is very, very important. I'll also point out, by the way, that again, and I hinted at this in my opening remarks, the peace accords yesterday, the Abraham Accords, wasn't just moving, wasn't just significance, wasn't just about peace, but this kind of unfair treatment of Israel gets harder and harder when you have Arab-Israeli normalization. I saw one op-ed that said that the Abraham Accords mark the death of the BDS movement. Now, that was a headline. I think that's a little bit premature, but there's no question that the Abraham Accords puts us on the road to the death of the BDS movement. It becomes very, very difficult to argue in any kind of persuasive fashion that Israel needs to be singled out for special treatment, for economic strangulation, when, you know, major Arab countries are not only signing deals, but embracing. I mean, the warmth of the embrace by the UAE and Bahrain was unbelievable. It was an embrace with abandon is what it was. And it's incredibly exciting, and it gets very, very hard to continue to maintain this campaign of delegitimization in international bodies. Now, on campus, sure, but on international bodies, it gets harder and harder. And I think once you see more Arab countries lining up, as I believe we will see soon, I think you're going to see it get harder and harder for the UN to maintain this.
Well, I think that we look forward to that day, and amen to that. You know, as far as
amen, for sure,
to making those moves. Ilan, I really, you know, I know you're short on time, and I want to stay true to promise that I will only take some of your time today. So I really want to publicly thank you again for taking the time out of your busy day and finding a time for us. It is it means a lot.